So good morning, let's start this briefing. Today is Tuesday, 21st of October, here in Geneva at the UN. And I would like to start by giving the floor to Shoko Arakaki, who is the director of UNFPA's Humanitarian Response Division here in Geneva, and who would brief us on the situation of women and girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You have the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. And then dear colleagues, and good morning. I have just returned from Democratic Republic of Congo, or we call DRC, where I visited Kinshasa and Goma to witness firsthand the reality facing women and girls caught in one of the world's worst neglected humanitarian crisis. Sometimes or often characterized as displacement, protection, and health and food, nutrition crisis. Throughout the visit, I also reaffirmed our collective commitment to their health, rights, and protection in their situation, humanitarian situation in the DRC. I met extraordinary women and girls living through unimaginable hardship. I spoke with midwives who continue to deliver babies under extremely difficult conditions. I listened to mothers who had lost everything, to young girls who still carry the scars of violence. I also met local partners, including women-led organizations and the frontline health workers who continue to serve their communities with courage and compassion. I was indeed devastated to listen to a story of a 14-year-old girl who was raped several times. She was repairing a fistula caused by the rapes at one of the UNFPA-supported hospitals. She told me that she still dreams to go back to a school after recovery. This is a story represent many that I heard. Congolese women and girls endure the tremendous suffering, but never give up on their hope. Even before current escalation of the conflict, three women died every hour from pregnancy and birth-related complications in DRC. Women and girls are also being raped, exploited, and then abused in camps, in transit, and within their own communities. Adolescent girls, among those most at risk, accounting for the third of reported gender-based violence cases. In the meantime, access to life-saving sexual reproductive health services has been significantly impacted by security situation and then access and the funding issues. UNFPA has designated DRC as an internal L3, level 3 emergencies, our highest classification in terms of severity and needs. It's reflect both the magnitude of the crisis and our organizational-wide humanitarian response and commitment to the suffering. We are actively, indeed, responding to the rise in conflict-related sexual violence, which has increased around more than 33% compared to the similar timing of last year. We ensure that the survivors receive medical treatment and psychosocial support. Our team are providing life-saving supplies, supporting health facilities to deliver post-rape care, and helping women and girls rebuild their lives through cash assistance, vocational training, and community resilient programming. The needs are growing, but resources are not. In 2025, UNFPA is targeting 1.4 million people with humanitarian assistance in DRC. As we near the end of the year, just half of UNFPA appeal has been funded. We must remember that without access to sexual reproductive health and gender-based violence services, women and girls will die. And women and girls in the DRC need us more than ever. Thank you for your interest and looking forward to your question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shoko. And let me just add that the 2.5 billion humanitarian needs and response plan for the Democratic Republic of the Congo is currently just 16% funded, with 410 million received so far. Our health partners urgently need 6 million to procure essential supplies and maintain life-saving services. Urgent measures are needed to ensure the continued functioning of healthcare facilities in all areas affected by crisis, especially in the eastern part of the DRC. Additional funding is required to prevent a greater tragedy. We also call on all parties to uphold their obligations under international humanitarian law to protect civilians, protect civilian infrastructure, including health facilities, and to ensure safe and unimpeded access of humanitarian aid wherever it's needed. And I'll open the floor to questions now. Let me see. Robin, AFP.
Good morning. The scale of rape and abuse and exploitation that you just detailed there, what is the government in the DRC doing about this situation?
Yes, indeed. I actually met the Minister of Social Affairs and Humanitarian Actions in the DRC. And then she was really passionate. She was really, really emotional, I must say, knowing what's happening in the East side. And government of DRC is always supportive about protection of women and girls and then responding to the conflict-related sexual violence, including, of course, gender-based violence. But the new situation right now, they cannot go in. So while the government is really care, but also asking our help, because we are the one who can really go to the territory. I just want to highlight that we get good support from the government for this issue.
Thank you. Other question in the room? I don't see any. Let me see if on the platform we have anybody who has comments or questions for you. I don't see any. So thank you very much, Shoko, for coming and telling us about this important mission and also putting the spotlight on this other terrible situation which we've been seeing for such a long time in DRC. So I'd like to ask now Eber to join us on the podium. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If I find the... you can sit here, please. I know the building is complicated these days. Thank you very much. So I think you have already met Abir Etefa, the Senior Regional Communications Officer and Spokesperson for the Middle East, North Africa, and Eastern Europe of the World Food Programme. I think you briefed already the journalist at last briefing, and you are here to give us a further update on the situation in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me one more time, and happy to provide further updates on the situation in Gaza on behalf of the World Food Programme. I think on Friday we had some developments on access, on deliveries. Over the weekend we've seen also some further developments. So let me walk you through the latest on our operations on Gaza. So I think since the ceasefire started on the 11th of October, we've now have over over 530 trucks into Gaza, supporting bakeries, nutrition programs, general food distributions. So far, we've had over 6,700 tons of food. That's enough for close to 500,000 people for 2 weeks. Daily deliveries continue, and they are now averaging around 750 tons. That's much better than what we had before the ceasefire, but it's still well below our target, which is around 2,000 tons every day. With full access, we plan to restore regular food distribution networks, expanding to 145 distribution points across Gaza. When I briefed on Friday, I mentioned that we've had now 5 distribution points over the weekend. This is now up to 26 distribution points operating, with more reopening as the conditions permit. Most of these distribution points are in the south and center of Gaza, Deir al-Balah, An-Nusayrat, Khan Yunis, Al-Mughazi, Al-Bureiji, and the response has been really overwhelming. People are showing up in large numbers, grateful for the efficiency of the delivery of food assistance, as well as the, you know, dignified way of people standing in line, quickly getting their food rations. And especially impacting the most vulnerable, the women, female-headed households, the elderly. These are our top priority at the moment. As we stand, also, there's still the delivery of fresh bread on daily basis, 9 bakeries, but we still need more to go. We need to be up to 30 bakeries across Gaza. But for this to happen, we need large quantities of wheat flour. We need to up the game in terms of the delivery of more food supplies, and specifically wheat flour, to be able to get the 30 bakeries. As we speak, 500,000 people are benefiting from these, from the fresh bread, distributing around 100,000 bundles, 2 kilograms each, to help families. So as I mentioned, the good thing is that we're getting to the most vulnerable, the women, and the assistance include the general food distributions, the bread, as well as the, you know, cash, some cash to a number of the most vulnerable families. Over the next 3 months, we would like to get to 1.6 million people. We're also scaling up the nutrition support for the pregnant and nursing mothers, and very important that we get into the north, to North Gaza. We've managed to get some distributions in Gaza City, but not at the scale that we would like to see. It's very important that we get all the food, all the border crossing points open at the moment. Since Friday, and you know, since we spoke, we still have only Kerem Shalom and Zikim only open for the deliveries, which does not really serve the north. So it's very important that we get into these border crossing points. Sustaining the ceasefire is vital. It's the only way we can save lives and push back on the famine in the north of Gaza. Full implementation will allow WFP to operate at the scale required for this crisis and effectively support all the partners and the distributions on the ground. So my colleagues have been able to travel to different parts of Gaza over the weekend. So we have, I can give you some, description of what people are telling them. I think my colleagues, I spoke to them this morning, they said that some of the women showing up in the distribution centers are saying that they are, before the bread distribution began, they relied heavily on neighbors and friends. One woman lost her husband. There were days that she had to ration food because the children, because she doesn't know what comes next. So the children would have to skip meals and eat every other day. Now, with the fresh bread in hand, they feel that they can at least, there's something that they can count on instead of the, you know, and she can go herself because she is a priority for the World Food Programme. I think the other element is that people are hopeful. There is cautious optimism, but they are the food that they are receiving. They eat part of it, and they ration and keep some of the supplies for emergency because they are not very confident how long the ceasefire will last and what will happen next. So they are unable to really consume because they are extremely worried, consume the food supplies because they are extremely worried that they have it today, but they might not have it. They might not have the same level of assistance in another few days. It's a fragile peace. Some of the people are saying 2 days ago there were airstrikes. We were told it's safe. We were told it's a ceasefire, so we don't know, should we move back home or stay here? We're in survival mode. We're still eating less, spending less, hoping more, but that's basically the mood among the families that my colleagues are seeing in the different food distributions where they have been, where they have seen. The most important thing for us, the ceasefire needs to hold. WFP and other humanitarian agencies are scaling up operations. They are starting to, push for more clean water, food supplies. Shelter is one of the biggest problems facing families as they are returning home to in many of the places. We've seen also on Sunday that we were not able to get food supplies into Gaza through the crossings because of fighting, but we know it's a fragile ceasefire. The most important thing is that it lasts and people continue to hold on to hope, as well as our teams on the ground. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abir. And let me join your call for this, as we also at the UN are encouraged that the parties have reaffirmed their commitment to implementing the ceasefire in Gaza. And we do remain concerned, as you said, by all the acts of violence in Gaza and the reported attacks and strikes that took place this weekend. We urge all parties to honor all their commitments, ensure protection of civilians, and avoid any action that could lead to a renewal of hostilities and undermine humanitarian operations. We reiterate the Secretary General's call for the release of the remains of all the deceased hostages. And I'll open the floor to question. I see Christiane, German news agency.
Good morning. Abir, could you explain a bit, why are you not able to take 2,000 tons in every day? Can you give us a bit more detail what the bottlenecks and obstructions are? And do you see looting of the WFP trucks inside the territory still? Thank you.
So a few things, just because I forgot. We have a video news release that will be out today with footage of food distributions of the movement inside Gaza. So you'll have a collection of freshly collected content and footage, video footage from the ground in the last 2 days. That's one. The other thing is that also I, when I mentioned the distribution of cash, I meant it's the digital vouchers that we're giving to families so that they can go back to the market and are able to get fresh food and produce. And that's mainly for the most very vulnerable families. And these are the mainly the severely malnourished who need complementarity to the food basket that we're providing, which is always, dry food rations. In terms of your question, first question is on the why we're not seeing the scale up. To be able to get to this scale up, we have to use every border crossing point. Right now, we're only using Kerem Shalom and Zikim. So, of course, the capacity, the pressure, the movement inside Gaza with the severe amount of destruction makes it you know, almost impossible to get to this goal of 2,000 tons unless you are able to utilize all crossing points. So we need this to open. We need, of course, that requires a lot of coordination on the ground. So we're hopeful that we're going to get to this point, but it is happening slowly. As I mentioned, over the weekend, we've had more distribution points happening, and the team is, you know, pushing everything on the ground so we can get to this to that level. In terms of looting, we haven't seen looting, actually, of our convoys since the ceasefire, since the opening of the supplies. I think people are reassured now that, you know, if they wait, that they are going to see more, you know, and they are, you know, seeing that convoys are coming constantly. You know, people, the bakeries are starting to run, and that's an important element psychologically, so that people are patient and wait for food supplies to come. Plus, also, we are not seeing any, you know, kind of the armed groups on the ground that also, you know, took part of these looting events at a certain point. So, happily to report that convoys are pushing through, food is getting to the warehouses, and distributions are happening in an organized and dignified manner. So that these are the two questions, yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm really sorry also. I mentioned that it is Kerem Shalom and Zikim. Actually, it's Kerem Shalom and Kisufim. Zikim is in the north, and it's not yet operational. So it is, just to reiterate, it's Kerem Shalom and Kisufim that are open at the moment.
Yeah, Kerem Shalom and Kisufim, absolutely. Emma Farge, Reuters.
Good morning. Great to have you with us in Geneva. Two questions, please. One on the crossings. Have you got any indication when the northern crossings will reopen, and why the reluctance on the Israeli side to open them, given the scale of the needs? And secondly, given that there has been a famine in northern Gaza, and there are pockets of people who I imagine who have been isolated and you haven't been able to reach yet. Are you concerned at all about refeeding syndrome, people who have been deprived of food for so long, possibly suffering from having too much too quickly? And if so, how are you planning for that? Are you seeing any cases? Thank you very much.
So on your first question, no, we don't have an indication on when these border crossing points will open. On the refeeding, I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
If people are getting too much to eat after a long time of privation, they should not have problems, and how are you preparing for that?
I think I'm not sure that we have the enough food for the whole population to see that we have a refeeding syndrome. I think people are just like, still what they are getting is, you know, is enough, but it's not too, and as I mentioned, people are nervous about the future of the ceasefire and whether they'll continue to get access to food or not, but we have not heard from on the ground that there is a refeeding program, a problem, and we have nutritionists with our teams in Gaza, so I'm sure that they are looking into that, but we haven't gotten into the point that Gaza is flooded with food and families have more than what they need.
Other questions in the room? To Aver, Isabel Sacco, Spanish News Agency.
Thank you. Just on the weekend, we all expected Rafah to open. So were you doing preparations for that at any moment? Were you really ready to use this crossing point? And if yes, whether you are still preparing to use Rafah? Thank you.
At the moment, we're using Kerem Shalom, and we will continue to use Kerem Shalom for sending supplies. I don't, I don't know if Rafah is yet operational for commercial and for you know, for humanitarian cargo. So I don't think we have immediate plans to use Rafah. We will continue to use Kerem Shalom in the south to push supplies into Gaza. And it's unlikely that it's going to be used for humanitarian cargo, given the level of destruction as well. Yeah.
Okay, Robin, AFP.
Thank you. What about fresh food, bringing fresh food into Gaza? How much of that have you been able to bring in? And secondly, food that makes it to markets. Do you have an indication of what sort of prices staple foods on markets are going for? Because we've heard reports in the past that things which are available to buy are extremely expensive and beyond the reach of a lot of people.
So traditionally, our food basket will not include fresh food or produce because of the you know, fragility and vulnerability of these you know, food items in terms of spoilage. But this is why it's very important that we keep the voucher program, because that allows people to go to the markets and to get what they need in terms of fresh food supplies, whatever is available. This is why it's very important, and we always advocate for the commercial supplies to get in. I mean, humanitarian aid and supplies will not be the only solution for you know, dealing with severe malnutrition and, you know, and having a complete food basket. So it's very important that we see the commercial supplies get in. Now, in terms of the, we've seen reports that, you know, because supplies are getting in, the food prices have dropped, but not to the level that it can be affordable. There's still a huge problem of access. People, you know, can find food in the market, but it's out of reach because it's extremely expensive. We believe that, I think prices have gone down, and We're trying to, this is why it's very important to get to the most vulnerable. 200,000 people should be getting these voucher programs to be able to access food in the market. So I think we're hoping to get the private sector to continue to push and get supplies in the market.
Mo? Yeah.
Could you say when this voucher program will begin, if you, the recipients, when they will get electronically or in paper? I don't know how it works. You mentioned electronically, that could be the best, but in any case, when they will have these to be able to use them?
We've already started. So 50,000 people have already received these vouchers, and they're able to go to the markets and redeem them. And again, the plan is to get to 200,000 people. That's 10% of the population in Gaza, the most vulnerable.
One more question for you on the platform. Nick Cumming-Bruce, The New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking the question. Abia, I wasn't quite clear what access you have had to the north. Have you had any convoys into the north since the ceasefire? And if so, when, how many, and when? And what's your assessment of the number of people who are living there and the kind of conditions there that your staff on the ground are finding? Thank you.
So we, in terms of access to the north, we've had one distribution of nutrition supplements for the pregnant and nursing mothers. We've had, and children who are suffering from malnutrition. We've also had some nutrition snacks that are important to provide some, you know, nutrition items that you don't get from, you know, the regular food supply. Which is being distributed in these temporary learning spaces for children, but we haven't had large-scale convoys into the, you know, the Gaza City or to the north of Gaza. We've cleared the roads at scale into the north, but we need these crossings to open so that we're able to get large-scale convoys. think the team has worked since the 11th of October on making sure that all the roads from the border crossing points, are cleared, so that we facilitate this quickly. We're ready. We hope. We're just hoping that it doesn't take too long before these crossing points are open.
And he was asking if you have any idea of how many people are still living there and which conditions.
I don't really have the exact number of how many people are still inside in the north, but the IPC on that was published on the 22nd of August has put the number of people in famine or risk of famine at around 500,000, so 500,000 people are facing famine conditions in the north of Gaza. It's a very dire situation. We've lost access, to the north of Gaza for a month now. So it's the situation is extremely dire, and it's a priority to get, of course, to the northern parts of Gaza and to Gaza City.
Satoko Adachi, Yumiuri Shimbun.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for doing this. I have two questions. How many staff does the WFP have inside Gaza? And secondly, are you able to work with the staff of UNRWA for the distribution of your supplies inside of Gaza? Thank you.
On your first question, I would need to get in touch with the team on the ground to know exactly how many staff we have on the ground. On your second question, we'll continue to work with all our partners on the ground, and we coordinate with UNRWA like all other UN agencies, UNICEF, WHO. There is coordination happening on the ground, and we're also working with the logistic clusters, with the, facilitating the movement of supplies. Applies on behalf of the UN partners and NGO partners inside Gaza. So we're working with all agencies on the ground.
Maybe just to add that I think it was yesterday when UNRWA said that with the ceasefire in place and as more areas become accessible, UNRWA has been expanding the number of temporary learning spaces set up in community shelters for displaced people. Imogen Folks, BBC.
Yeah, hi. It's just going back to the access to the north. Just to clarify, you said you had cleared the roads. You mean you have cleared the roads from the northern crossings to the places in the north you might like to reach? And then secondly, to expand on that, are we to understand that you really to get from, say, Kerem Shalom to the north is just impossible at the moment? Is that because the roads are blocked or mined or you're prevented? Could you just clarify that exactly, please?
So on your first question, when we say clear the roads, it means that we've removed the debris from the border crossing points to be able to connect to Gaza City. So that's on the first question. On the second one, it is the level of destruction and access from the south to the north is going to be extremely difficult. So this is why we need Erez, we need Zikim, we need these border crossing points to be to open so that we can easily access with these large convoys into Gaza City and the north of Gaza.
Thank you very much. Is there any other question for Abir? I don't see any on the platform. So thank you so much for this update. I hope you continue coming and briefing the journalist. So thanks. So that brings me to my final announcements. First of all, I have an important announcement for you for the trip of the Secretary General that has been announced yesterday in New York. Let me remind you that tomorrow morning, the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, will arrive in Geneva to participate in a special session of the World Meteorological Congress commemorating the 75th anniversary of WMO. The session will spotlight the Early Warnings for All initiative, where the Secretary General is expected to reiterate his urgent call for universal access to life-saving alert systems. Immediately after this event, the Secretary General will proceed to our Palais to attend the 16th session of the UN Conference on Trade and Development. I understand this morning you had a briefing from Maria Navarro on the developments of the conference, which, as you know, will last until Thursday. Following this session, we will have the Secretary General in this room. He will be joined by Carlos Cuerpo, who is the Spain's Minister for Economy, Trade, and Business, and they will officially launch the Sevilla Forum on Debt. I think you have received yesterday evening the invitation to this press conference. The forum is a key milestone in advancing commitments made during the fourth International Conference on Financing for Development, which did take place in Sevilla, in Spain. And so we will have the Secretary General, and then he will leave on Thursday to go to Hanoi, and following that to the ASEAN meeting in Kuala Lumpur. I also wanted to announce you an invitation that I think you have also received. It's in your mailboxes. On the 24th of October, we are going to mark the official 80th anniversary. We'll be speaking a lot about that, but on the 24th of October, we will officially commemorate the 80th anniversary of our organization. We will do so in a little ceremony in the Salle des Pas Perdus, where we will also open the photo exhibition UN at 80, Shared Lives, Shared Future. It will be, as I said, on Friday at 12 noon, so just after the briefing. You're invited to attend this ceremony, which will be held with the Director General of the UN Office at Geneva, Mrs. Tatiana Valovaya. The exhibition that you will see will present 27 powerful stories showing how the UN makes a tangible difference in people's daily lives, from advancing peace and security to providing humanitarian aid, as we have just heard, fostering sustainable development and promoting human rights. Two of the individuals that are featured in the exhibition will also be there to deliver remarks together with the Secretary General. Just to inform you that this is part, this is the Geneva leg of a global initiative organized by our Department of Global Communications in collaboration with the UN Information Centers and the permanent missions of Italy, Slovenia, and Switzerland in New York. The full online version is much bigger. It's about 200 stories from 193 countries. They will be featured on the UN 80 web page, and there will be there additional information about all the events in the world and also about the individuals that are featured in these images. Let me see if I have another press conference, sorry, to remind you. This is on Monday, 27th of October at 10:30. The Minamata Convention on Mercury will, the colleague will brief you on what to expect at the sixth meeting of the Conference of the Parties to this convention, which will take place in Geneva from the 3rd to the 7th of November. The speakers will be Monica Stanievich, Executive Secretary of the Convention, and Brenda Kirk, the Senior Coordination Officer of the Convention. And I think I have told you everything we had. Emma.
Is it possible to ask a couple of questions on Gaza to WHO and OCHA? And
of course.
I also had a question for Claire, if possible.
Let me see for Claire. Yeah, Claire is there. Jens is in the room, so I will invite him to the podium. And we also have other colleagues ready to answer a question on Gaza, including WHO. I think Tariq is there. Okay, so Emma, do you mind if I listen to that first? Okay, Isabel, go ahead, and then while we are opening the connections with, I don't see Tariq yet, but yeah, go ahead. But can you use the mic, please? Can you use your mic?
Mr. Guterres will also make a speech in the UNTAD conference. I didn't hear that. Secondly, I didn't get really the email on the event with the Spanish minister. So I don't know what time is that. And finally, if given the fact that we will have a we have rarely the Secretary General here. Will we be able also to ask a few questions of news? Thank you. Okay.
About the program of the Secretary General. Yes, absolutely. As I said, the Secretary General will speak first at the WMO Congress, and they will have some interactions with the participants in the Congress, and then he will move here and he will speak to the UNCTAD 16. He will also be accompanied by a number of representatives of the regional groups. Then we will have a family photo opportunity, and then they will all come here for the press conference. The press conference invitation, I have sent it to you all yesterday evening. It was pretty late. Yeah, it was about 8 o'clock. I was still, yeah, I remember perfectly the time because it was late. But definitely, yes, the speakers to the conference will be, as I said, the Secretary General, Carlos Cuerpo, the Minister of Economy, Trade and Business of Spain, and Rebecca Greenspan, the Secretary General of UN Trade and Development, and Lee Junhua, the Undersecretary General United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, will be there, will be here on this podium. To launch the Sevilla Forum on Debt. The Secretary General will have to depart after the opening statement, so I don't think we will have an occasion to ask him questions. However, Mrs. Greenspan and Mr. Li Junhua will be staying over together with the Minister of Economy, Trade and Business of Spain to answer your questions. So it will be a proper press conference only. He will have the time only to do the opening statements, but then he will have to leave. But you will hear from him definitely on this occasion. I don't think anybody who's not accredited to the UN is listening to me now, but I tell you, in case you have colleagues that have been accredited to UNCTAD in particular, if these colleagues don't have the permanent accreditation to UNOG, they will have to register for the conference as explained in the advisory that I've sent out yesterday night. And Isabel, no worries. I mean, if you haven't received it, I definitely send it again. You had a third question I think I've forgotten. No, it was all. Okay, thank you very much. And then I know you have a question for Claire, but and she's online, but let me first start by giving the floor to Emma, who has a question for Jens and for Tariq, if we found Tariq. Go ahead, Emma.
Yeah, sure. Jens, it's actually on the West Bank. I know that in a humanitarian update recently you gave some details of incidents of violence by Israeli settlers against farmers in the olive harvest. BBC ran some footage of a Palestinian woman being clubbed in the West Bank as she was picking olives. Can you tell us anything about how bad it has been this season compared to previous years, and how concerned you are about attacks on Palestinians during the harvest? Thank you.
Emma, sorry, I see Tariq is connected. Do you want to also ask his question?
Yes,
your question to him.
Morning, Tariq. It was actually on Rafah and medical evacuations. Do you have any indication when that corridor will be reopened and how big a difference will that make to the enormous backlog? Thank you.
Start with Jens.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. I'll need to read into that West Bank thing, so if we can take that separately. Of course, we're always concerned about settler violence, and we have seen an uptick in that, but I'll have to look into the exact numbers in our reports for you. Thank you.
Tariq?
Hi, thank you very much. So I can't really to tell you when it will open, but we, as I said, we need all these referral pathways to open as soon as possible, so we can, as you rightly mentioned, clear this backlog and try to get as many people as possible. Over 15,000 people need to be medically evacuated, including more than 3,000 children. We will, as we have done in the past, we have been informing about the evacuations. So just stay tuned. We'll provide the information. And also, you have seen the 60-day plan that we issued on Friday, and one of the things that is a priority in the next 60 days is to scale up medical evacuations to get to 50 patients and accompanying person per day. So basically, to match what was the number of people getting out to get medical care before the escalation of hostilities. So we'll keep you posted on that.
I'm lost now. Who had a question for Claire? You did. Okay, go ahead. She's listening.
Good morning, Claire. I hope it's going well over there. I understand that you're going to be discussing a little bit this week the financial situation of the WMO, and I profess ignorance on this. I'm just wondering, has the US also cut contributions to the WMO, and can you give us any details if so? And are you also affected by the overall retrenchment of European donors given security priorities? Can you just tell us what the situation is and what you will be discussing this week? Thank you.
Yeah, so the financial situation will be discussed on Thursday. It is live streamed, so you can access it. I think it's Thursday morning, probably most of Thursday actually. So, you know, please tune into that for more information. Yes, you know, the US, as with all other UN agencies, the US is a major contributor. We are still awaiting assessed contributions from the US, awaiting quite anxiously. The US delegation is here and is playing, you know, a very active, very constructive role in discussions. So it's our extra budgetary funding. We, unlike, you know, many other agencies, we did not rely heavily on the United States for that. So it's more, you know, it's more the regular budget, and we are awaiting the you know, contributions on that. In terms of the European situation, at yesterday's high-level segment on early warnings for all, we did get a couple of pledges, including one from Spain for, I think it was 5 million euros. That was for, you know, specific projects. But I think, you know, that is why we are having the, you know, the discussions on Thursday, just to assess where we are, you know, where we need to be. So I can't really say much more than that at this stage, but you are welcome to tune in. This morning, while I'm online, I've got the floor. This morning, we had quite an interesting special panel on artificial intelligence and weather forecasts. And, you know, the main message on that is, if we snooze, we'll lose. So, you know, big... There's a lot of momentum happening in AI, in weather forecasters, in all other domains. And we heard this morning really quite interesting presentation from Norway and from Malawi, with Norway sort of teaming up with the Meteorological Service from Malawi to try to help fast track them to more advanced weather forecasting capabilities by using AI models. So if you're interested in that, just let me know. I can give you more details. And third, and finally, and most importantly, the Secretary General's arrangements tomorrow, his His interactive dialogue will be broadcast on UN television, also live stream from WMO. Space is extremely tight. It's even tight for, you know, for the members of WMO. So, you know, whilst obviously accredited photographers, TV cameras, you know, you are welcome. Please just confirm your attendance with me. For written media, I would recommend it's probably more efficient for you to follow the live stream, because you know, there will be quite heavy security, and space will be very, very tight. I will send you the WMO Secretary General's written text under embargo, so you will have that ahead of the speech. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claire. Other questions for any other colleague who is connected? Nick, I see your hand. Is that for Claire? I can see in the chat you have not received the invitation either. I have just checked. You were all in my message. So this is really strange. I will send it again with pleasure. And but please check your mailboxes, because I did send it yesterday night. But Nick, maybe you have a question to Claire?
Yes, thank you, Claire. Good morning. Yeah, I just, in relation to US funding, do you have some numbers at your fingertips there? What percentage of the overall assessed contribution comes from the United States? And when you talk about waiting for the US to pay, how far in arrears are we talking? Are you waiting for the 2025 contribution, or are we going back further than that to 2024 as well? Thank you.
I need to refresh my memory on the figures. From what I understand, I think it's 21% for the assessed contributions. And yes, 2025. We haven't heard word either yes or no. I think probably other agencies may be in a similar position to us. But as I said, you know, the US delegation is here. They are, you know, playing a very constructive, very active role in the discussion. So, and as the WMO Secretary General has said time and time again, you know, whether climate and water know national borders, you know, this is why global collaboration really is the key, and that is one of the main messages of the WMO's 75th anniversary, that, you know, we've been exchanging data, you know, for 75 years now. The World Weather Forecasting Program, you know, World Weather Watch, you know, preceded the World Wide Web. So we've been doing this for a long time. The US has been right at the heart of the action, you know, from the very beginning, and they remain, you know, at the heart of action. They are very, very crucial, very important, a very important member.
Thank you very much, Claire. Satoko.
I just want to check with what you said. Since when the United States has not paid their contribution? Since 2024, am I wrong? Since the Biden administration. Thank you.
Let me double check. I understand it is also from 2024, but I'll double check, and I'll get back to you on that.
Thank you very much. Any other question? If not, thank you again. I think I'll see you all for the press conference of the Secretary General, and then we will see, of course, each other on Friday, and hopefully at the ceremony for the 80th anniversary. So thank you very much, and I'll send again the invitation just now. Thank you.